webpage. It'll be part of George Mason if any of them want to use any of the ideas. So let me start out with one of my favorite ideas, which I've never tried to do. And this one combines the completely unrelated fields of economic history and history of economics. George Stigler somewhere comments that in an essay on specialization that anybody who claimed to be expert in both of those would obviously be a charlatan. And because it starts with Adam Smith, and it starts with an Adam Smith essay, Adam Smith's project on economic history. Some of you probably know about Smith and the diamond shoemakers. Smith has the following explanation for the decline of feudalism. He says, we're in the early Middle Ages, you are a feudal lord, and your income is basically in grain and other food products. That's what the land that you are ruling over is producing. How can you spend it? The human stomach is of limited size, you can't eat all of that food. So what do? You use that food to feed retainers. And you now have a bunch of people around who will bow to you and treat you as a high-status person, all of which people like. And incidentally, you now have a free army because all of these people who you were feeding, mostly because you like to be surrounded by sycophants, are also people who, since they owe their income, their food to you, will be willing to fight for you. And you therefore have a political system in which military force is controlled very low down in the scale. In effect, a king is really just a coalition leader because it's the individual local lords who have the troops. Now, he doesn't put it in that language, but that's what he's basically saying. Feudalism. Right. I like to think of sort of the defining feature of feudalism as being that the essential resource is controlled at the local level, and therefore the high-level leaders are coalition leaders. So I would argue, for example, that big city political machines are feudal, the essential resource being not heavy cavalry, but votes. And the votes tend to be really controlled by the local sort of precinct people who their voters are loyal to. Anyway, so now what happens? Well, now Smith says, as division of labor increases, international trade increases, and now there's something else I can do with my grain. I can export my grain, get money for it, and use that money to buy diamond shoe buckles. And that, he says, since people always would rather spend their money on themselves than on anybody else, the lords prefer doing it this way. Now, they are still feeding just as many people as before, but now the people they're feeding are scattered around the world, producing these goods they're getting by trade, so they won't fight them for them anymore, so lords no longer have free armies, so you shift to military, more nearly centralized military power and feudalism. It's a really neat idea. And it occurred to me that it ought to be possible to test it. And the central idea of my test is to consider two different lords, one of whom is producing wine, and one of whom is producing grain. And wine is mainly an export good. So if the guy producing wine wants retainers, he's got to export wine and import grain in order to feed the retainers. He'll consume a little wine too, but mostly they need grain. Whereas the guy who's producing grain can get retainers by producing grain. Hence, the rate of exchange between retainers and diamond shoe buckles is different for the two people. That the guy who is producing, whose land produces mainly export goods, has to give up 10 retainers to get a diamond shoe buckle, whereas the guy whose land is producing grain has to give up 100 retainers to get a diamond shoe buckle. Therefore, you would expect that the willingness to switch from retainers to diamond shoe buckles would be higher in the one than in the other. And therefore, if Smith is right, you ought to be able to look at different parts of West of Europe in the course of the Middle Ages, see which ones were largely producing food for consumption and which ones a significant part of what they're producing was export goods, and see whether feudalism by some measure or other fades out earlier in the one than the other. And if you really did it right, you'd also want to think about transport costs, because one of the striking facts until about the 19th century is that the only cheap way of transporting goods is by water, and therefore if you had an inland area where there weren't good navigable rivers, the diamond shoe buckles are very expensive because you've got to export your goods, get money, and then import shoe buckles and such, whereas if you're on the coast, it's really easy. So I don't know if it's doable or not, but it struck me it would be really a neat research project to see if you go back and say, well, Mr. Smith offered this conjecture a few years back, let's see if we can test it. So that's my first project, and I'm sort of fond of it. Another one which occurred to me, which I also haven't really done much on, although I think I may have somewhere a very brief draft on it. Some of these things I have written material either at home, back in California or maybe even on my computer here. So if you decide you're doing something, let me know, and if I have anything, I can send it to you. But this one has to do with the issue of adversarial versus inquisitorial court procedures, that the American and British system is one where the job of getting evidence that you are innocent or guilty in both civil and criminal cases is subject to division of labor, that there is a plaintiff's attorney or a prosecutor, public prosecutor, whose basic job is to find the evidence that you're guilty, and then there is a defense attorney whose basic job is to find the evidence that you're innocent. Now, presumably prosecutors won't admit this. The prosecutors claim they're trying to find whether you're guilty, but given the system of incentives, they've got a strong bias in that direction. Whereas the inquisitorial system, and again, this is a cleaner distinction than real institutions have, but in principle, the inquisitorial system is one in which people working for the judge go out and look for evidence, and if they find out evidence, they're innocent, so they give it to the judge, and if they find evidence that you're guilty, give it to the judge. And the question is, what are the advantages of the two systems? And the obvious argument for the inquisitorial system is that it doesn't waste evidence. That if the defense attorney finds evidence that his client is guilty, he will discreetly ignore it. And one suspects that prosecutors do the same thing in the other direction, even though, again, they're theoretically not supposed to. And if you think about a civil case, a tort case, it's pretty clear that the plaintiff's attorney is not... is going to do his best not to report to the judge any evidence that he can find that the defendant is innocent. So that looks like a very wasteful system, whereas the inquisitorial system, you've got neutral people or whatever they find. And I'd wondered, now there are obviously arguments the other way. In particular, you might be worried with the inquisitorial system, the judge isn't really neutral, and then there's nobody on one side of the thing. But that's sort of the standard argument. The argument I came with was quite different. And that is the inquisitorial system, sorry, the adversarial system may result in giving people a incentive to reveal private information. Because suppose I am a defendant in either a criminal or tort case, and I know that I'm innocent. I say, well, since I'm innocent, a dollar spent on looking for evidence that I'm innocent is likely to be quite productive. Because after all, you know, the real world is out there. I'm really innocent, so you look for evidence. Occasionally I'll find evidence that I'm guilty because the world is complicated and some evidence is misleading, but mostly I'll find evidence that I'm innocent. So I ought to be willing to spend lots of resources looking for evidence and getting myself off. Whereas if I know I'm guilty, I say, well, maybe if I try very hard, I can find some evidence that I'm innocent. But it's going to be really hard because after all, I'm guilty, so most of the evidence I turn out is evidence I'm guilty. We'll have to throw that away. I should hire a lawyer who is a good demagogue and can sway the jury, but I shouldn't spend much resource actually looking for evidence. So the argument then is that there is going to be a self-revealing process where people who know they are innocent generate more evidence that they're innocent due to greater efforts in addition to due to the more evidence being out there. People who are guilty won't. And that would be a real advantage of the inquisitorial system. Now, it's not a rigorous argument. I hope you're a good enough economist to realize that you could set up elasticities in such a way that the guy who's innocent says, I only have to spend $100 because that'll produce enough evidence, and the guy who's guilty says, I better spend $10,000 in order that I can finally find a few bits of evidence on my side. So I'm not claiming it to be a rigorous argument. If you did this thing, you'd want to work through the theory and state more precisely the conditions in which it's self-revealing. But then you would like to see if there's some way of getting evidence. And you might be able to look at some measure Anglo-American system, some measure of efforts by the defense and efforts by the prosecution or by the plaintiff, which you could then correlate with acquittal versus conviction, which presumably gives some evidence as to whether or not people were acting guilty, though not, of course, perfect evidence. So that would be sort of part of it. I should say, with all of these projects, I predict that if you really do it, and if you're any good, you will come up with ideas or directions to go that haven't occurred to me. That's my experience as a fiction writer, and it's my experience as a researcher. That I did a piece, for example, on 18th century English criminal law, and it turned out that both of the central issues in the finished article weren't there in my head when I started. I was initially thinking of that as the famous Bloody Code in which everything was capital, and the old Becker argument that you should always, it looks as though you always want to increase punishment, decrease probability, keeping deterrence the same because that saves resources, and it looked as though, well, maybe if they if they hanged you for everything, maybe they did that, so let's look at it. It turned out they didn't hang you for everything. That system was interesting for two quite different reasons, the fact that it was privately prosecuted and the fact that they pardoned a lot of people. So, as I say, what I'm offering is really a starting point. Hopefully, if you do it, some of what I'm looking for will turn out to be there, but hopefully you'll also go off in your own directions as you start exploring. All right, next one is one that occurred to me some time ago, and I rejected it after I thought I proved it was wrong, and then some of the people here have been trying to persuade me that I was too committed to rationality, and if I weaken that a little bit, maybe it's not wrong. Part of the reason for their persuading me of that is that if my argument is right, not only is my theory wrong, there is no such thing as insider trading. That seems a little bit implausible. But I started out with a puzzle, and I'm not positive the puzzle is real, but at least it was sort of widely believed to be real. And that is that the rate of return on stocks is higher than on bonds. All right, this is a common claim about American experience. The people have argued that maybe it's based on a typical period of time when stocks for a long time did very well. I don't, I'm not an expert on that stuff at all. I'm a theorist, not an empiricist because I'm lazy. But supposing it is true that stocks on average give a higher return than bonds, and that this can't be adequately explained by higher variance, because at least the claim that's made is that almost any time in the 20th century, if you bought stocks and held them for 5 years or more, you, with very rare exceptions, you would do better than if you bought bonds. That's the claim I've seen, and I have not really investigated the claim. So the question is, how is it possible? Because the obvious argument is that you're an investor. Why would you buy a bond with a return of 5% when you're getting 8% in the stock market? And I have this really neat explanation. And the explanation is that on the stock market, everybody is an insider. And the argument goes as follows. Imagine that I have special information about some little tiny bit of the stock market, so that I am working for a company. And either I realize that that company is really much better run than other companies I've worked for, a fact which the market in general won't be aware of yet, or I realize that they're really running for a fall, and the market doesn't realize that. In one case, I would buy, in one case, sell. Take the buy case, which is the one I thought about. But it doesn't have to be that. I was actually inspired by one of my lucky, or maybe not lucky, actions, which was a very long time ago when the Apple Macintosh came out. And one of my colleagues at Tulane Business School, where I was at the time, when I said I was going to get a Mac, said, well, why don't you get a PC Junior instead? And he was thinking about the physical size of the two machines. And he did not realize that the central processing unit of the Mac, of the original Mac, was a Motorola 68000, which was a way higher horsepower machine power processor than what the PCs were using. And why did it have this processor, which had normally been used for multi-user machines before? Because running a graphic interface takes a lot of horsepower. And it was the first sort of commercially successful rank, the Xerox. Had done it for sort of experimental stuff, but not, say, been sold on a serious level before, graphic interface machine. And I had seen stuff on the earlier Xerox experiments. It was clear to me. I had been using not an IBM, but a personal computer of the earlier generation for some years at that point, and it was clear to me that the Mac represented a breakthrough, a really important improvement. But it was also clear to me that nobody around me realized that. That here I was in a bunch of business school people, and they wanted to know why I wasn't getting a PC. And I said, aha! I have some inside information. I should buy Apple stock. And I did. And I also, for a related reason, some years later, bought Microsoft stock, again, on the theory, at least, that I had figured out things from my specialized information. This is a point when very few people have their own computers, and I was one of those few. I spent a quarter at UC Irvine, which is where I discovered word processors. This is a long time ago. And they had a dedicated Wang word processing system. And the way the system worked was the professor typed up his paper. He gave it to the word processor ladies. They retyped it into the word processor. They gave him the printout. He marked his corrections, gave it back. And it occurred to me that in this cycle, the word processor ladies had negative marginal product. Because it is easier, as everybody in the world now knows, it is easier to write on a word processor than on a typewriter. And so I persuaded the word processor ladies to teach me how to use their machine, and I came in the evening and wrote a draft of a book that I never finished and never published, but did other stuff that way, and came home knowing that I needed a word processor. And I did a little research and discovered there were two ways of getting a word processor. One of them was to get a dedicated word processor, and one of them was to get one of the early pre-IBM personal computers, which had a word processing program on it, and they cost the same amount. Well, I didn't see any particular reason why I should get a machine that did one thing when I get a machine that did that one thing and 20 other things as well. So I got an LNW80, which was a super clone of the TRS-80, for those who know ancient history of computers, and never turned back. So I was sort of early on and was, from my standpoint, an insider in the sense of having information that other people had, but very few other people had early on, and so I made some bets on that. So now, I say, let's look, everybody's in that situation, each for a little tiny niche, different niche, company you work for, your hobby, whatever it is. So I say, well, I've got money to invest, obviously I want to invest in my niche. Because in my niche, since I'm an insider, even though the normal return is 4%, I can get 8%. But if I've got very much money to invest, I don't want to invest all of it in the niche because I'm risk averse. In addition to which, the niche may well be where I'm getting my salary, and risk aversion means that I want to diversify out of that. So therefore, I, as investor, invest the first half of my money in my niche, and I get an 8% return on that, and the second half of my money on the market in general, I get a 4% return. Now, what's the marginal return on investing capital? It's 4%. I've already filled up the niche up to the risk aversion point. Consequently, it's the 4% rate that's in equilibrium with the return on bonds, assuming that I'm not an insider on bonds. Consequently, we would consistently have a world in which the average return in stocks was higher than on bonds, but the marginal return was the same. And I thought that was such a beautiful idea. I really liked it. And then it occurred to me there was one small problem with it. And the small problem is that if the average return on stocks is 6%, say, in my story, why am I buying stocks stupidly at 4% as an outsider instead of buying 1/1,000,000th of the entire market and thus getting the average return? And that's the point at which I stopped. And then it eventually occurred to me that not only did this argument prove that my theory was right, it proved there was no such thing as insider trading. Because in a market where insider trading is a significant factor, there ought to be no patsies. Right? Insider trading only works if when the insider wants to buy something that he knows is worth more than its current market price, someone's willing to sell it to him. But fully rational people without inside information, anytime they're not insiders, ought to be buying a random sample of the market and thus getting the average return, rather than being the losers whose mistakes fund the gains of the insiders. So at that point, I say, well, everybody in the world seems to believe there is insider trading, so maybe the argument is wrong, and maybe there's enough irrationality or enough new people on the market who think they're insiders when they are, or something like that, so that insider trading model works, in which case my model could work. And I stopped at that point because it would be really neat, and this is the one where if you do it, I want you to have a footnote crediting me with the original idea, because I thought it was a really neat idea, but it's not the kind of research that I'm likely to do. So that's my next one. Right. Let me go to an entirely different one. And that started with the puzzle of why countries that consume intellectual property and don't produce it are nonetheless willing to agree to enforce intellectual property laws. And maybe the answer is some combination of bullying and bribing by the other countries. I'm not quite sure. Or something else. But it occurred to me that it would be interesting to investigate the spread of agreement to intellectual property across countries to try to see what was actually happening. Because you've got the obvious free rider potential of a country which says, well, you people can reward authors and inventors by having IP law. We'll just buy inventions and books. Why should we pay anything extra for them? We've got our own legal system. We don't have to go along with your IP rules. And as you may know, there are at least two prominent cases of countries that did that. There is the recent case, which is Taiwan, which I think is now signed up, but for many years Taiwan was the pirate nation, but it was not a party to the copyright treaties, and you could go to Taiwan and get cheap copies of English language books, very cheap. They're also cheaply made, as it happened. And of course, the bigger example around 1900 was the U.S., which did not have a copyright treaty with Britain, and therefore it was not obliged to pay copyright. And that's another interesting story for other reasons. But it occurred to me that it would be much easier to study this mechanism if you had many worlds. And you could therefore say, well, a world with 3 countries, what happened? A world with 100 countries. Ah, but we do have many worlds. Because for copyright, a language is a world. for copyright, conventional copyright. I'm not thinking about modern computer stuff, which is really pushing copyright towards patents, but ordinary copyright of books. Yes, I would like to have my rights protected in Germany because some of my books have been translated into German. But as a general reason for most rule for most authors, almost all of their sales are in the language their books are written in. So therefore, copyright is almost entirely relevant only in the world of a language. Well, we've got lots of worlds. We've got English with, I suppose, let me guess, 10 countries of significance which have large English-speaking markets. Spanish with probably even more, Portuguese only two that matter, Portugal and Brazil. So therefore, one could look at the spread of copyright laws by taking each language group as a separate world and do some statistics. Were countries in a two-language world where it's really easy to get to coordinate much quicker to agree to copyright than countries in a 20-language? Just Portuguese versus Spanish would be a nice comparison. I never did the research. I did a little bit of writing up of the ideas, and that I even have on my computer now. But it struck me that it would be a neat research project for somebody who wanted to look at something. So that's another one to kick around. Now here's another one. That from time to time there are news stories about how loopholes in the tax laws have been closed, or the tax laws have gotten more progressive or less progressive, stuff like that. And it occurred to me that it would be quite neat to look at the legal changes against a measure of how progressive tax really was. And that there is a sort of a neat objective measure, and that's the premium on tax-exempt bonds. That anybody whose income is coming from capital can always get a certain implied tax rate by deciding to put his capital into tax-exempt instead of ordinary securities. And therefore, if you looked at the rate of return on tax-exempt bonds versus the rate of return on otherwise similar investments that weren't tax-exempt, you would have a measure of the marginal cost of avoiding taxes, as it were. And you could see how that measure changed year by year and whether it had any interesting connection with changes in actual tax law. And again, you'd want to think it through a little more carefully because this doesn't apply to people whose income is all from salary. They don't have the option. And it doesn't really apply if your income is coming from capital, but you're a brilliant investor and you get a much higher return than. But it does apply to anybody who's sort of a coupon clipper kind of person. And that's got to be some significant fraction of the high income taxpayers. And therefore, laws that made things harder for coupon clippers ought to mean that that people who were issuing tax-exempt securities could borrow money cheaply, whereas laws that made things easier for coupon clippers should have the opposite effect. So it struck me would be sort of a neat research project. Maybe someone has done it. I don't know, but I've never seen anybody doing it. So that was my next idea. All right. My next two involve fairly major political disputes, which I think I have a little tiny bit of a handle on how you might get empirical evidence. I'm not sure either of them. And the first one I think of as the question, do governments spend what they need or spend what they can get? So that you've got, in a sense, two different models of the process in people's hands. And one of them is why the reason why governments spend more now than they spent 100 years ago is that there are more useful, important public goods that have to be produced. And the other model, to take one example, is the reason they spend more than they did 100 years ago is that many more people are working for large organizations being paid salaries. That makes tax evasion much harder, and therefore they can charge a higher tax rate before the point at which they run into declining returns. Or alternatively, an alternative version of that same explanation is, in a poor country, if you tax people too much, they start starving to death, and then you can't collect taxes from them. In a rich country, you can. So therefore, as countries get richer, the amount taken by government goes up. So those are two quite different models of the process. And the question is there any way of getting empirical evidence between them? And the sort of standard example that's used, but which other people have looked at, is what happens after a war when you've got lots of people already raised the taxes. They don't have to go through the political hassle of raising taxes. You've got lots of money, so you spend. I was thinking of a different case. And what I was thinking of was U.S. states, which have different mixes of taxes. So if we happen to have one state which gets its income mainly from income taxes, and another which gets it from property taxes, where the value of property is, for taxable purposes, is almost never changed. So it's really a constant return rather than a real measure of property. And incomes go up. One of them is getting sort of a free ride of revenue and the other one isn't. And if the model is they spend what they need, then when that happens, the one with the property tax system is going to raise its tax rates, or the one with the income tax system is going to cut its tax rates. Whereas if the model is they spend what they can get, then each one will adjust its spending accordingly, and that will be locked in forever. So it seemed to me that you could do it, and I actually made an attempt at this, but I'm not an expert on the relevant institutions or on statistics, so it probably has things wrong with it. But I did at one point have an unpublished paper in which I had tried to compute for different states how income elastic their tax bases were, and then look at whether you could predict later levels of expenditure by distant past, that you could say, well, it takes a little while to adjust. But the question is, if you got a free ride in 1910, are you still spending more in 1980? And I think I concluded you were. But as they didn't get to the point where it was publishable, I did sort of give a talk on it at one point, but didn't get a lot of encouragement.
So your empiric supported the...
But supported is really too strong. It was at a fairly early level, so I'd be happy to turn it over to somebody else. Again, I want credit in the footnotes. But that's all I really ask on that one. There's another one which is even more the central political issue, in fact. And the central political issue is whether the marginal product of government spending is more or less than a dollar for a dollar. All right? That really is the issue people are disagreeing about. And it occurred to me you might be able to test that. And you test that by using a slight improvement on the Thiebaud model. Because the problem, at least with the Thiebaud model, I've never read Thiebaud's piece, so this may be unfair to the original, but the way it's usually presented is it ignores the fact that land can't move. And therefore, one way of looking at it is that you can run exploitive taxes up to the point where you're in effect expropriating the land. Because as you raise the tax level and pocket the money, the result is people leave your jurisdiction. As they leave the jurisdiction, land prices go down. As land prices go down, your jurisdiction becomes a more attractive place to live in, because if you leave, you'll have to sell your land cheap and buy expensive land somewhere else, and if you move in, you can buy houses cheap. So therefore, the Thiebaud model isn't quite right. It really suggests that you will have efficient production of public goods by local governments, plus expropriation by whoever can get control of that government, maybe some waste resources in seeking and rent seeking for control of the government, up to the value of the land. And it occurred to me, put aside that argument for a moment, because I'm not interested in critiquing Thiebaud, that this also suggests that changes in land value ought to be a proxy for the net effect of government spending, namely the effect of the taxation plus the spending. So that if it is the case that a dollar spent on by a government produces $2 worth of benefit, then on average, when governments spend more money, land value should go up. And the other way, they should go down. Now, it's not a trivial problem to actually look at it empirically, and I'm sure I never did do this one. I just thought about this one. Because, of course, the fact that they spend more money is itself reflecting other changes, which could easily affect land values. So what you would need to do would be to look at exogenous changes in government spending in some sense, and I was tying it into the previous project and thinking about when they got windfall money from changes that raise tax revenues, but you could also think about cases in which a federal government starts giving more money to the states. You could think of lots of, and on some rule which gives more to some than others, say, and that would be tricky, of course, because then the question would be that land values go up enough to reflect the windfall from the federal government. So I guess what I really want is something in which the central government changes rules in such a way that some state and local governments raise expenditure and taxes. They got to pay for it themselves, and others don't. I don't know if there are any good examples. Again, I didn't really do this. But the basic idea would be to try to say when there is some exogenous change that results in some local governments taxing and spending more and other ones not, which direction the land values move in those areas. So that struck me as a very hard project to do, but on the other hand, sort of earth-shaking consequences. If you could really, you could start a whole literature, but of course, whichever result you get, somebody will then want to write an article proving the opposite because it's politically so loaded. But it would be really neat to have set off this project of, look, the conservatives are right, every dollar you spend is 50 cents down the drain. Or, look, the liberals are right, every dollar you spend is an extra dollar in people's pocket because it produces $2. So it's sort of a central important issue, and you are welcome to think of other ways of testing. But I'm not sure that I've ever seen anything where anybody seriously tried to test it. Everybody just goes on political things on one side. There. Next one is a project which comes out of my anarchist interests. And that is, as I mentioned in one of the talks that I gave, I think, last week, if you're thinking, imagining a society where you have private firms selling the service of rights protection, and those firms can contract with each other to agree on arbitrators or settle disputes between their customers so we don't have to actually fight each other, and we then have an interesting sort of game, and game theory is a lot of fun, but I don't think it ever really gives you any very clear and unambiguous answers. And the game is fight or arbitrate. The game is, on the one hand, if my agency is a bully and says, we believe our customer is always right, well, if that were costless, we could provide a better service to our customers. But on the other hand, other people aren't going to put up with it. So to what extent in such a game do firms end up agreeing on arbitrators instead of using violence? And it occurred to me that exactly that game is being played out in a perfectly legal market at the moment with auto insurance companies. That you have auto insurance companies, which I'm arguing are analogous to my rights enforcers, that when my car runs into Peter's car and we have different insurance, if you have the same insurance company, the insurance company doesn't really care which of us pays for it, but if we have different insurance companies, the insurance companies have a choice. They have a high-cost way of settling it, which you can think of as the equivalent of shooting each other, and that's suing each other, going to court. And they've got a low-cost one, which is to use some simple rules of thumb for arbitrating the dispute. And my impression, and it's not a subject I've studied, is that they almost entirely use the low-cost mechanism, and I find that encouraging because that suggests that if my anarcho-capitalist system were set up, people would very rarely shoot each other and they would almost entirely arbitrate. And I guess we have a little bit of evidence from places like Somalia that the result is also right, but I guess Iceland too, but which are systems are a little bit like what I'm imagining, but not exactly. But in any case, it occurred to me that somebody really ought to look into the history of auto insurance companies and arbitration mechanisms, because, you know, it's got to be well recorded. We've only had cars for about 100 years. I don't know how long auto insurance has been a major industry. So it would be quite neat first to study the current industry and to figure out how do they do this arbitration, what percentage of cases go to court, and why do those cases go to court. One reason to take a case to court is suppose it's a really novel case. Suppose we have no experience with this kind of case. We don't know what the right rule of thumb is. We want rules of thumb that will do a good job of producing the same outcome as court cases, because then nobody has an incentive to go to court. So our two insurers kind of say, look, let's take this one to court and generate a little information on how courts decide it. If that would be really neat if that was what was happening. But it could also be that what's happening is that my insurance company says, look, you guys, I got deep pockets. I've got the equivalent of tanks in my backyard, so you'd better accept rules I like or else I'll keep going to court and bankrupt you. And I want to know which of those is happening. So the researching first the current situation and then the history of it would be a really neat project for somebody to do. All right, let me now go on to a number of cases which come really out of the stuff I've been doing recently, looking at different legal systems, and where there are things, questions I'd like somebody to answer, but which also might be a good research project for someone else. And the first one is the question which I've never really gotten a clean answer to, and someday I will, and that's how cross cases are handled in polylegal systems. Polylegal system is a system where the same territory under the same government has two or more different legal systems, and some people adhere to one legal system and some to another. And the one that I guess I'm most familiar with is Sunni law, that in Islamic law, as some of you may know, there developed four different schools of law. This process was finished by about 1,000 years ago. That all of them believe that they derive the law from the Quran plus traditions of the practice of the Prophet Muhammad. But since that doesn't, of course, include answers to enough questions, they then use various approaches of logic and analogy and so forth, not identical in the different schools, though somewhat similar, to decide what the legal rules ought to be. And the schools regard each other as mutually orthodox. so that none of the schools claim the others are heretics. And my understanding is that a major medieval Islamic city would have had a separate court system for each school. And that's fine as long as all the cases are intracommunal, as long as the bunch of people in this neighborhood of the city are all Shafi'i, and therefore their cases go to the Shafi'i court, and the ones over here are all Maliki, and there's... But what happens to the crossings? What happens when a Shafi'i sues a Maliki? And I know the answer for the American legal system. It may not have occurred to you that you're under a polylegal system, but in fact, the law that determines a case... In many cases, it depends on the state whose law prevails. And once you think about it for a while, you realize that not all cases have a clearly defined geographical location. And there, if you were law students, you would at some point study a bunch of stuff I haven't studied on how we decide which state law applies. But it turns out that sometimes the answer is no. That in, you will have a case where a citizen of one state is suing a citizen of another state, and the issues are not obviously linked to one state or another, and then there's a rule called diversity jurisdiction, which says that a federal court can take that case just because of diversity, even though it's a state law case, not a federal law. So that's one example. And that suggests that one possible solution is that you have a higher level court which only deals with cross cases, which federal one also deals with federal law, but forget about that. So you could imagine that maybe in this medieval Islamic city, there's a special court whose job is to handle the cross cases. Or you could imagine that perhaps one of the four courts is the court of the school that the ruler adheres to, and it gets to settle the cross cases. But you can think of other possible ways. You could say the rule is that it always goes to the defendant's court. Somebody sues somebody else. One way of mildly discouraging lawsuits is to say, well, the defendant's court might have some prejudice toward in favor of the defendant, so therefore you've got to be pretty sure you're right to sue, so let's make the rule that it goes to the defendant's court. And I can think of a variety of other possible rules. And I thought it would be an interesting project for somebody who was interested in doing bizarre stuff. I should say that one of my informal jobs is being the OTW referee for journals, OTW meaning off the wall. Which is why I get crazy articles on things like 18th century pirates to look at, which is fun. So this is for people who sort of have OTW tastes and would like to figure out how medieval Islamic law settled this and what happened in England when prior to the 16th century, Welshmen in Wales were under Welsh law and Englishmen in Wales were under English law, and what happened during the Reconquista in Spain, when recently conquered Muslim villages were allowed to keep Muslim law for 100 years, well, they're allowed to stay Muslim for a century or something, they're allowed to keep Muslim law for some period of time before eventually, and so forth and so on. So that, and undoubtedly there are cases that never occurred to me, which correspond to the same thing. So take a look at the mechanisms used to settle cross cases, maybe what problems each of those mechanisms raises, how they're resolved, and you would have quite an interesting specialty that nobody else had ever specialized in, I'm pretty sure, because I've looked pretty hard to try to find the answers to these questions, and this is, of course, one example. One of the books I'm probably not going to write, but somebody ought to write, is on the exploitation of students, because the point, of course, is having especially graduate students who are, you can exploit better than undergraduates, but you can do pretty well with undergraduates, is how do you get them to do work that you want done, so as to answer questions in this project along those lines. Another one coming out of the same kind of issue is looking at feud systems. That feud is one of the ways in which legal rules get enforced. Probably it's true in most societies if you expand it broadly enough to include not just fighting people, but making bad rumors about people and insulting people and other ways in which you... And the guts of a feud system, as I see it, is that the enforcement mechanism is the private use of force or the threat of the private use of force. So that in the most primitive version of feud system, for which my example is the Roman Child Gypsies, who are the largest gypsy group in England, the basic logic of the system is, you have wronged me, I go up to you and tell you you've wronged me, and I tell you I'll beat you up if you don't compensate me. And what's behind that is that there is a system of norms in our community, and if you really have wronged me, and I can convincingly show it, your friends won't back you and my friends will back me, and so you'll lose when I beat you up, so therefore you will compensate me. Or maybe you'll leave town, that's the other option. That's primitive feud system, that's the one that's around at the moment in England. There's another one that the Kali Gypsies in Finland use, but I don't understand this clearly, so what its name is. But then there are two sophisticated feud systems that I actually know a reasonable amount about, and those are Saga Period Iceland and Traditional Somali. And those are both systems in which there is no executive government, all actual application of force is private, but in each of those, there is a fairly elaborate mechanism to get a verdict without violence. So in the Icelandic is the centralized version. In the Icelandic system, there is a legislature, there is a court system, but there is no executive government. So when you have wronged me, I sue you in the court system, going through an appropriate set of procedures. The court gives a verdict. You owe me 50 ounces of silver. You pay me 50 ounces of silver. That's fine. But why do you pay me 50 ounces of silver, given there's no executive arm of government to enforce it? Because if you don't, I will go back to the court and it will outlaw you. And it is legal for me or anybody else to kill an outlaw, and it is tortious for anybody to protect an outlaw. So once you're outlawed, you've got 2 weeks to leave Iceland, and then you're fair game. So that's a feud system, because the ultimate enforcement is the use or threat of private force, but it is a very organized feud system with its own explicit legal system, explicit legislature for changing the legal system, and as best I can tell, only occasional violence in most of the things. Somalia is the decentralized version of that. That in Somalia, at least according to the one book which I've got on Somalia, and I've got to see if I can find some others, because there are probably some other books as well. And that book is written by somebody whose political views are too close to mine, and he's heavily biased, and therefore I don't entirely trust him. And he's also dead, so I can't ask questions. Although I can't ask questions of his editor, and I'm doing so. But the Somali system, as he describes it, is the decentralized version, in which there is, again, no executive arm of government. But this time, there are traditional ways of choosing judges. So I have a dispute with you, and there is a mechanism we will normally go through in which there is a member of my kin group who is thought of as my elder, and typically only one, although it looks like there might occasionally be more than one in my kin group, and he is supposed to be one of the two judges and your corresponding person the other, and those two judges get together in an ordinary case, and they ask us to agree to accept their verdict, and probably we do agree to that, and they give a verdict, and if the person who loses won't act according to it, it is then the judges then ask some of the strong young men in the village to go use force against the person who won't, and they can make him do it, various procedures. Why does somebody who thinks he's going to lose agree to a judge? Because if you don't agree to a judge, now the other person is entitled to self-help, which means that he and his kin members can go beat you up or can seize some of your property or do whatever, and if they seize too much property, you then countersue him and so forth. But it's essentially a system in which, by the description, through mutually recognized customary procedures, there is a mechanism by which almost all such disputes are peacefully settled, with somebody owing something to somebody else. But it's still a feud system, because what's ultimately backing it is the threat of private violence, basically. So it seemed to me that I've now got four of these. I bet there are 50 others out there in the anthropological and historical literature. There might even be some analysis of non-violent feud systems in modern societies and the mechanisms by which people in corporations or in ethnic enclaves enforce rules against each other. And it would be quite a lot of fun, rather than doing what I'm doing, which is a few of them and try to understand them very well, to try to survey everything known about feud systems and say, well, are most of them decentralized or most of them centralized? What issues arise? The decentralized ones break down more, do the centralized ones break down more, to just learn about feud systems by taking them seriously. And that the reason this probably hasn't been done is that people hear the word feud and they say, oh, we know that's a stupid, primitive way of doing that. Hatfield and McCoy's. It turns out the real Hatfield and McCoy story is a story about how the almost immediate settlement of the feud settled for 5 years, and then the governor of Kentucky decides to intervene, and that's what revives it and results in another three people being killed and one person being hanged, after which the feud disappears again. The whole Hatfield-McCoy infinite killing is just a popular fiction. Almost certainly. Obviously, there are always historical actors, but I think it's pretty clear that that's the real story. So once you recognize that feud systems are, in fact, one of the viable ways in which real-world legal systems have gotten enforced in lots of different societies, for some societies, maybe very well be the best way of doing it, then you take them seriously, and then it'll be fun to actually study them. And maybe it's been done in the anthropological literature. I'm not aware that it's been done, so that would be neat. All right, next one also comes out of the stuff I've been doing of late, and that has to do with the Amish. And the Amish, for those of you who aren't in my Wednesday workshop, have a political system in which the largest, quote, government, unquote, has got perhaps 200 people in it. That their basic unit is what they call a district, which is a congregation, and every congregation has its own law. The law, these are people within the U.S., so they're subject to U.S. law, of course, with a few exceptions, but they also have various forms of social pressure, of which shunning is the extreme, the equivalent of capital punishment, which can be used to enforce their own rules on their own people. And those are called the Ordnung, and it's an oral, in almost all cases an oral rather than a written, I think there are a few cases of written Ordnungen. And each congregation of maximum size of a congregation is about 40 households. One of the really neat things about the Amish is the reason that they have these tiny microstates is that they don't believe in building churches or meeting halls, and therefore an Amish congregation has to be small enough so that everybody can fit into one house for church services, or one barn in some areas, or one shed, but some ordinary private building that exists for other purposes as well. And so when they get past 40 households, they can't squeeze into even a big farmhouse, so they split into two congregations. So quite an interesting set of institutions. But what occurred to me while looking at it for my purposes is that this is a world, there are, congregation is, say, 150 people, and there are, say, 200,000 Amish at this point, maybe more than 200,000. Now, I should say their population growth rate is nearly 4% a year. So the result is that there are a whole lot more Amish than there were 80 years ago. I've seen the numbers, it's maybe more than a tenfold increase, I think, in that time. And so there's lots of data. I mean, they're in modern-day America. People study them. They vary in various ways. Basically, if your ordinance does not forbid you from owning an automobile, you're probably not Amish. That's one of the ones that change all of them. But there are lots of other areas where they vary. In particular, one of the interesting ways they vary is in how severe their equivalent of capital punishment is. There are two versions of shunning, and some congregations adhere to one and some to the other. And the strengmeidung, the severe form, the basic rule is that if you break the rules of your congregation, and if after the people from your congregation point this out and ask you to reform and apologize, you refuse, you keep breaking the rules, they then excommunicate you and and impose shunning on you, which means that basically no Amish will have dinner, will eat with you, will talk with you. I don't remember the full details, but basically a very limited degree of food is associated with you. In the strengmeidung, this status continues until you go back to your own congregation, apologize to them, demonstrate that you're no longer committing whatever sin you were committing, and they agree to forgive you. And the Amish are pretty strong on forgiveness, so if you really are willing to go to forego whatever evil thing you were doing, then they probably will forgive you. The weak version of it, if you go to any Amish congregation, including one which has a much weaker version of the rules than yours did, and therefore which may not ban whatever you were doing, and get them to accept you. Or even if you go to a Mennonite congregation, the Amish were split off from the Mennonites some centuries back, and they're similar, but the Mennonites are less extreme. Once you have been accepted by some reasonably closely related religious group, and you've demonstrated that, you know, you've not just been accepted just yesterday, but you're fitting in, then in the weak version of banning, your congregation will say, all right, you're not one of us anymore, but you are obeying some version of the rules, so therefore we will remove the shunning. Your family can talk to you again. So it's not a trivial difference. And thinking about it sort of a priori with a little bit of evidence, it looks as though the strengmeidung should make people less willing to defect because the cost. Now, in principle, you can defect by leaving before they ban you, and then you ought to be all right, because just leaving is not an excommunicatable offense. It's being a member and violating the rules, but it should tend to keep people in. On the other hand, keeping people in has got this downside that you keep troublemakers in. And so my initial guess, and I'm not sure it's right, is that Strengmeiden congregations should lose a smaller percentage of each generation than the weak Maidug, but should have be more inclined to fracture and have other internal problems. And stuff I was reading, I saw a little bit that seemed to confirm that pattern, but I'm not sure. But it just occurred to me that there's pretty clearly a whole lot of data out there by which you could try to sort of slice up the different congregations by different characteristics. They do it themselves. The two congregations whose ordinance, whose set of rules are reasonably similar, may choose to be in affiliation with each other. And you will have affiliations of a whole bunch of congregations. In particular, the oldest large settlement in the U.S. is in Lancaster. It's not the biggest anymore. And all of the congregations in Lancaster are a single affiliation. So that means, among other things, that a preacher from one of them can guest preach in another. It means that it's fairly easy to marry across congregations. It's not impossible across affiliations, but it's much harder. But I think that's the only large settlement of which that's true, that most of the settlements you have two or more different affiliations. There's one area where there are five settlements very close to each other in southern Indiana, of which one of them is Schwarzentruber, which is sort of the, in their terminology, lowest, that is, most severely restrained one. One of them is New Order Amish, which is one of the least severely restrained. Two of them are Swiss, meaning that they're descendants of the second Amish migration in the 19th century rather than the first one in the 18th century, and they all have Strengmeidung. I'm not sure what the other differences are. So you can have quite a lot of fun if you think about wanting to study governments. And these really are governments, even though they're micro-governments with limited abilities. And here you must have, I suppose, roughly 1,000 of them, 1,000 congregations. And the congregations clump into affiliations and into settlements, which are not the same thing. You can have two congregations that are 500 miles apart but are affiliated with each other. And you can have two congregations next door to each other, in fact, on top of each other. That in an area where they're all in one affiliation, the congregations get treated as territorial sovereigns. So if you want to change congregation, you have to move. But in the areas where you've got multiple congregations that aren't affiliated with each other, with different views of what the rules are, they can be sitting on top of each other, and you can say, all right, I'm not going to move my farm. I'm just going to go to this other congregation, which is in the same territory, and ask if they'll accept me. Tell my own congregation I'm no longer a member of your congregation. You just switch governments without moving, all right, like the anarcho-capitalist model, so to speak. So it just seemed to me that if somebody was willing to seriously devote time and effort to learning everything that was known about these things and doing a little driving around Indiana and Ohio and Pennsylvania, which are the three states that have most of the Amish in them, talking to people, it would be a big project. It would be a lot of fun project because it's an interesting set of institutions in a lot of ways. I should say the Amish are not anti-technology. That's a myth. What the Amish are is believing in controlling technology. So that what's basically going on, and they're doing it congregation by congregation, although of course they talk to each other. So what basically is going on is that the congregation is deciding, would this technology subvert our social system? Cars will subvert our social system. Our social system depends heavily on social ties being clumped. So that your neighbors are also the people your kids court, are also the people you mostly do business with, are the people you worship with, and so forth. And easy transport is going to mess that up. People are going to start developing social bonds 20 and 30 and 50 miles away. The compromise that they have is you can ride public transportation, you can hire a van driven by a non-Amish, so that for important things like attending the wedding of a relative who lives 300 miles away, you can travel, but it's inconvenient enough so that you keep the existing system working. And it really is quite an amazing system. I mean, this is a system that's been running for several hundred years. It's one which does involve quite noticeable costs. One of the other rules that pretty much all Amish adhere to is you can't connect to the power grid. You can use battery-operated power. You can probably use generator-operated power, I guess, because many of them use diesel engines and stuff. So they're not really anti-technology. But you can't connect to the power grid. That makes it too convenient. And telephones. Most of them won't let their members have a telephone in the house, although that's one of the ones we think has been fudging a little bit. Some of them, there is a shack with a telephone shared by five houses, and you can go out to that telephone to make outgoing calls, but you're not going to have teenagers conduct crafting long conversations with somebody far away who's a friend, and which would undercut the cultural homogeneity that they're producing. So it's really, in a certain odd sense, as one of the books I was reading was arguing, they're more modern than the rest of us, not less, in that part of being modern is wanting to control stuff, and they are trying to control the influence of technology on their societies. And they're therefore accepting some technologies and not others. And it's a weird mixture, so that, for example, you'll have Amish farmers who have a horse-drawn wagon with a diesel-powered baler sitting on it, which they're feeding the hay to bale the hay. But that compromise seems to work for them. So anyway, Amish are interesting in lots of ways, but the particular thing I thought would be fun to do would be to think of them as 1,000 micro-governments, which, 1,000 now, obviously there were fewer in the past, where we've got all sorts of patterns of an area gets too densely populated, farmland is expensive, it starts throwing out colonies. That is, groups of households go 400 miles away from Lancaster to southern Indiana, where land is cheap, and they set up a new settlement, but they're still in affiliation with the people in Lancaster. And they go back to Lancaster twice a year for weddings and stuff. And they have much less to do with their neighbors 20 miles away who are a colony from a different original one. So anyway, it just struck me that if you think of doing sort of public choice kind of research, the Amish would be a really neat area, and I'm pretty sure it hasn't been employed because I've been reading everything I can find on the Amish. All right, so let me go on. I've got a few more ideas. One of the ones which I've actually discussed a little bit on my blog a long time ago is that social scientists have been complaining forever that we can't do decent experiments. That here the physicists can, you know, here's this thing here, here's the thing, you heat this and don't heat this, push, do whatever you like. But we only have one world. It's not true anymore. World of Warcraft by itself has got more than 100 worlds. They're called servers. Alright, so if you think about these massively multiplayer online role-playing games, of which World of Warcraft is the most successful, at least in the U.S., the way World of Warcraft is set up, is you have a server, this is a computer somewhere, and it's its own world. So if you play on Feathermoon server, which is what I and my family do, you are part of a world with thousands, literally thousands of human beings in it. I mean, one of the great breakthroughs of these massively multiplayer games was realizing that human beings are much better at pretending to be human beings than computers are. So an ordinary computer game, there's just you and the computer is being all the other people. World of Warcraft, there is you and, let me guess, 10,000 other people, 5,000 other people, something like that, who are all playing on the same server, who you are seeing as these dwarves or gnomes or orcs or whatever their character is, but who you can talk with as well as fight with, ally with, and so forth and so on. So it's quite an interesting sort of, I would argue, one of the really radical developments of the last few decades, maybe as important as television was. That's sort of my strong statement. But one of the things it is the perfect platform for social science experiments. Because you, if you are paying some not very high fee to have to play World of Warcraft, you are allowed to set up 10 characters on a server, and you can do 10 characters each on, I don't know how many, but on a whole bunch of servers.
Eight
servers at the moment. But with a reasonable research budget, you can make that 80, right? Just buy 10 memberships. So that means that any experiment you could think of doing, which the amount of disturbance that a single player could do, you could do one way on 40 servers and one way on the other 40 servers and see what happens. So I don't actually have any good ideas of economic experiments to do. But you could imagine, if you think about the about, it's not really economics, but about the way in which ideas or language or words spread. You could start, you just wondered, why is it that some terminology catches on and some doesn't? And so you could do an experiment where you said, I'm going to think of 10 different nicknames that could be used for some feature in the game. And some of them will be biological metaphors. And some of them will be mechanical metaphors. And you can think of some of them will be rhyming terms. So put each of them up on 10 servers and then watch and see which ones catch on. Maybe that's not a good experiment, but it was sort of an example of the kind of stuff you could do. Yes?
So is this in any way, do you think,
there are.
So you can pay money to switch servers now, right? It's like $5 to get one character from one server to another.
Yes.
Is that, in your mind, pose a problem for this sort of analysis? Or?
I don't think so. I mean, very few people do it. The one reason you might want to do it for your experiments is there could be some experiments that require a high-level character to do. And since it takes a lot of time and effort to get your character to a high level, you might want to have one high level moving around. That would be one way of trading money for time, as it were. But I was thinking of trying to do either an experiment where you can do the experiment by having a brand new character, for example, introducing a term into online conversation, as it were. The other thing, my earlier idea with regard to World of Warcraft was that you could use it to teach the economics course. And you have to do it at a big university, because the right way to do it is to have a course where all the students are already World of Warcraft players. Because otherwise there's too large a barriers in sort of learning that world. But if you had one where the player, where you set it up as, you know, this course only for people who are already World of Warcraft players. And there's a lot of interesting economics in World of Warcraft, because it's got markets. It's got multiple markets. It's got an explicit market, the auction house, which you can watch. And you can see what are the prices on that market, and when do they go up and when do they go down, and is it, for example, a market which meets rational expectation requirements? See, that's something you can do just by observing. You don't have to control anything. So that I have a very simple question, which I've never gotten around to testing, and that is, are there predictable patterns over the week? Are there things which go up in price on the weekend, let's say, when more people are playing, and down in price on other things? And the really interesting question is, are the swings limited by the auction house cut? In other words, do you have something where, yes, there are predictable patterns, but you can't make money by arbitrage because the auction house cut will kill you? That would be really neat if it turned out that, yes, there's a swing between the weekend and the weekday, and it's just the amount at which you can't make money by arbitrage. I don't know if that's true or not. But so you can imagine, either as a teaching device or as a research device. Part of what got me interested was when my wife described her experience encountering cartel activity in World of Warcraft. And cartel activity by somebody who had not read the classic article on Standard Oil and why predatory pricing doesn't work, and was threatening predatory pricing against my wife, who wouldn't join the cartel, and my wife basically said, that's just fine with me, and it lasted for about 3 days before the other person gave up. So in terms of either observing, I don't know, I was tempted. I ran into the same monopolist later when I was doing things on a different market. This is a player who, I don't know if he or she is actually, you know, somebody who's crippled in a hospital or whatever, but is playing, I would say, maybe 10 hours a day. It isn't all on the auction house. The player also, the character also does real things, but has at various points has been the dominant seller of certain things on a large scale, and in certain cases we know has essentially gone to other players and either said, "Why don't you join my cartel?" or said, "If you keep selling, I'm going to make sure you can never sell another thing. So get out of my market," essentially. So you can observe a whole lot of imperfectly competitive behavior there. You might, without getting involved at all yourself, just watching the auction house, you might be able to do it. You could do other things if you had a sufficiently high, in fact, it wouldn't have to be a high-level character. You could just look at parts of the auction house market, which were low-level stuff, so you could yourself engage in it. If you wanted to be able to make large plays, there is a black market for trading dollars for World of Warcraft gold. And if you're willing to go on that, and if your funding sources don't mind, you could, you know, spend a few hundred dollars buying a bunch of World of Warcraft gold and then use it to try to flood the market with something or other, or to try to set up your own cartel or engage in predatory pricing, whatever you want to do. It's just that the really neat thing is you now have a multiple world place to do your experiments in. So I am not, I mean, I play World of Warcraft, but I'm not that guy, and I've enjoyed observing some of this stuff, but I haven't actually tried to do any research, but I am encouraging other people to do it, and also any of you who end up as teaching undergraduate courses at a big university, I want somebody to try my World of Warcraft as a course idea, but I do recommend that you make sure that all the students are already players, and that you put some time and energy into figuring out what bits of economics, and you think about questions like, to what extent can you predict that this good is going to go down when that happens? Because they change the rules of the game, and they, to some extent, announce the changes in advance, and therefore you can see to what extent at the point the information comes in, things change rather than changing at the point when it actually happens. So there's a lot of intriguing stuff there. All right, let me give you two more things, which are just questions that occurred to me in the course of doing the research on my present book on legal systems very different from ours. And one of them is, why was torture commonly used in lots of different legal systems? And the most puzzling case for me is Greece and I think Rome, because under Athenian law, slaves could only testify under torture. That in a law case, you could use the testimony of slaves, but it had to be given under torture. And that sounds sort of crazy. And it's not like the Athenians are stupid, because there's the obvious argument against it that if you torture somebody, you'll say whatever you want him to say. And a lot of our evidence on the Athenian legal system is from orations written by professional orators. Basically, you couldn't have a lawyer speak for you, but you could have an orator compose an oration you would memorize and deliver. And some of these orations are literature and therefore survive. And there is a case where we have two orations written by the same orator for different customers in different cases. One of which makes the argument in favor of torturing slaves and one of which makes the argument against. So the art studio really saw the problems, as it were. So why do they do it? And the best explanation I can think of, and I'm not sure it's right, is that the argument depended on two propositions. One of them is that in almost all of these cases, the slaves have an incentive to say certain things, whether they're true or not, because normally the slave who's going to have useful evidence is going to be the slave of one of the parties. Wouldn't have to be, could have just been a random observer, but that's typically the case. He's got a strong incentive to serve his master's interests, otherwise his master will mistreat him later, which the master is entitled to do. So therefore you have to give him a balancing incentive to make him tell the truth if it's hostile to his master. But that doesn't do any good if you say, yeah, sure, so half the time you have slaves who lie for their masters, and half the time you have the slaves who lie so as not to be tortured, doesn't tell us anything. So you need the additional assumption that interrogators have some ability to recognize lies. And that's not an absurd assumption in the real world, and it's still less absurd than interrogators believe it. So if you say, look, human beings, especially human beings under pressure, for example, when they're being tortured, aren't very good at making up stories, so the lies are likely to be inconsistent, and so forth and so on. And, of course, occasionally the lie will include facts we can check against another source. So the easy case, of course, is if you said we torture them, well, we only believe it if what they tell us is where to lose him. We can then check that. But putting aside that kind of case, if you believe that the interrogator can usually recognize truth and lies, and therefore if we don't torture him, he'll just stick to one story, which is the story that benefits his master, and even if I think it's a lie, I never find out what the truth is, but if we torture him and we stop torturing him when the interrogator believes he's told the truth, now if he believes that he has an incentive to tell the truth, and if he doesn't believe it, and is just trying different stories, at least at some point he'll get to the true story. So that's my guess of what's going on, but it could be wrong. But we know that that was the case in Athenian law. I'm told it was the case in Roman law. I haven't looked into that. We know that witnesses were tortured in imperial Chinese law, although they didn't have to be tortured. It wasn't. I think you've got a different pattern, if I understand it correctly, in medieval and Renaissance Europe. I think there are legal systems, if I understand it correctly, where you can't convict someone unless he confesses. And so, therefore, once you're pretty sure he's guilty, you torture him until he confesses. And maybe he doesn't, because maybe if he's never convicted, his property may not forfeit, so he dies, but his heirs get the land. So there may be cases where he'll hold out guilty or innocent against torture. But anyway, but that would be a different case. But it would be interesting, and maybe someone's done this, I don't know, to investigate the use of torture in legal systems. Because it may seem outrageous to us, but it's actually historically pretty common. Another one, which is probably less interesting, but sort of occurred to me, is there are a number of legal systems that don't allow lawyers. That imperial Chinese law, they're very harsh on lawyers. They don't quite say it's illegal to be a lawyer, but it's awful close. And they first make rules against doing certain things, and then they enforce those rules against people who aren't doing those things, in effect. Icelandic, saga period Icelandic law, it was perfectly legitimate to be an expert in the law and give legal advice, but it was illegal to be paid for giving legal advice. And that's really unenforceable because you can always be paid with gratitude, which means somebody will help you out in some other way 2 years later. But at least that was the theory of it. 18th century England, it was legal to have a lawyer, but they mostly didn't. Well, some people did, at least. It wasn't standard until later. In Athens, as I was saying, you couldn't have a lawyer who was speaking for you at the trial, but you could have an orator do stuff. So it would at least be interesting to try to investigate, again, across lots of different systems, to what degree lawyers are illegal, lawyers are restricted in various ways, and so forth, and see if you can figure out if there are patterns. So that one. And my final one is one which lots of people are probably working on, but it's still an interesting question, and that's the question of why income inequality has increased not only in the U.S., but in a bunch of developed countries over the last 20 or 30 years. And I'm almost sure it's true. I mean, a few people have tried to argue that it's an artifact of the data or of the way the tax system works or something. Maybe it is. But I think I would see better arguments if it was true. So I think it is the case that in the U.S. over the last 20 or 30 years, the share of national income going to the top 1% or the top 10th of a percent has increased quite strikingly, maybe to double perhaps, something like that. And that a similar pattern exists in other developed countries. If so, why? And when I was in an online argument about this, I thought up four different conjectures. Not all original with me, and there are probably others I haven't thought of. So the one argument people have made is it's technological progress, that the kind of things being done by average people are replaced by machines better than the kind of things done by high-income elite people, that we can have a Roomba vacuum your room, but we can't have the equivalent to brain surgery, and brain surgeons are much more highly paid than cleaning ladies are. So maybe that's a general enough pattern so that the relative return to high talents versus medium talents, because it isn't just poor people, right? If anything, I would guess that the cleaning lady is probably less likely to be made obsolete than the checkout clerk, which are getting made obsolete by the self-service checkout things. But you could certainly imagine that there could be technological trends that substantially change the marginal productivity of different groups of bunches of talents. So that's one possibility. Another one, which I didn't actually mention, probably prudently, although most things it didn't occur to me, is the, I'm trying to remember the name, a very, very controversial book a few decades back, which was accused of being racist.
The
Bell Curve. And I only read the beginning of it, so I don't know if all the accusations are wrong. But at least judging by the beginning of it, one of their serious concerns was that America had become much more of a meritocracy over the last century. That it used to be that the students at Mississippi State University were not significantly stupider than the students at Harvard, they were just poorer and from less elite families. And the argument they were making was that it had become much more nearly the case in the by the time they were writing that there was a high correlation between how smart you were, how much money you made, and what university you went to. And that had a number of potentially dangerous consequences, but one of them was increasing a sort of mating, that it meant that it was much more likely that smart men would marry smart women. And if that's right, then you would expect the distribution of intelligence to start moving out. So if that's going on, that would explain the change in income distribution all by itself. All right. So presumably one could investigate. I mean, there are, after all, lots of IQ tests that are given and other things. There are things like the SAT exams, and you ought to be able to find out, have in fact the tails moving wider. That would be another possibility. Third possibility is that it's the combination of relatively free trade plus the fact that the third world is becoming the second or first world. That is to say that China and India now have progressed a lot, and they're selling us labor in the form of labor-intensive goods. So if we are, in effect, importing a lot of labor, not mainly by migration, but mainly by trade, then the labor-capital ratio goes up, the return to labor relative to the return to capital goes down, the high-income people are getting their return from either human capital or physical capital, so that would be a different version of why the returns to high-income people would be going up. So that would be a third explanation. A couple of other explanations that I threw in mostly because of the political context of the particular online argument would be maybe the degree of state and local regulation that keeps poor people from starting businesses has gone up over time. I don't know if it has, but there's certainly you can't just start a business as a barber or even a hair braider in many areas without the appropriate expensive licensing procedures. So perhaps that's the reason. And then another one, which I think is a good deal more plausible, is it may be the effect of the welfare state. That one of the rather striking things, which I discovered a long time ago, is if you look at the poverty rate in the U.S., which in theory at least is by a constant definition, it's falling steeply from World War II until about the point when the war on poverty gets really going. And that from about the point when the war on poverty is not really declared, but fully funded and staffed, poverty rates haven't changed. They've gone up and down with the economy, but roughly speaking, it's that pattern. Well, that's maybe not so surprising to the extent that you have the government engaged in making the war on poverty was supposed to make people not poor. It clearly didn't do that. That's part of the point of Charles Murray's book, Losing Ground. But what presumably it did do was make being poor less unpleasant. Well, it's not surprising if you make being poor less unpleasant that the incentive to do the difficult things necessary out of poverty goes down, and so maybe that ends the decreasing. And you could imagine that. Then you say, well, shouldn't it have happened earlier? Well, if the trend up started about 1980 and war on poverty is fully funded by the end of the 60s, it's pretty close. Furthermore, you might argue, and I'm thinking really more of the European welfare states than the U.S., that there's a time lag effect. That when, suppose you put in a welfare state such that working is still better than being on welfare, but not a lot better. And it's also, you know, a lot more trouble. You lose all the leisure. You can't play World of Warcraft as much when you have a job, unless you're a professor. And then, of course, being a professor is much better than working for a living. Some of you personally know, which is why you're here. Except when you have to grade exams. So grading exams is the only time it isn't. Not only because you have to read this horrible handwriting, which is almost as bad as mine sometimes, but because when you grade the exams, you discover how much worse a job you did than you thought you did. But anyway, putting that aside, imagine you're in a European welfare state and working hard really gives you some benefit, not very large. But on the other hand, you're in a culture where the fact that you have a job makes you a respectable person, the kind of person a woman will marry, the kind of person that people respect, whereas people who are on welfare are obviously failures. And you don't want to be a failure. And maybe in a generation or so that those set of norms fade away. You know, people who aren't on welfare are just foolish, hardworking people who are making life easy for the rest of us. So you could certainly imagine that there are time delays such that having a welfare state eventually results in the lower part of the income distribution sort of flattening down, in a sense, because people are less willing to invest in human capital, to work hard and so forth and push themselves up when they've got the not quite as good but much easier alternative of going on welfare. On the other hand, welfare isn't much of an alternative for a brain surgeon. So maybe what's going on is that the upper parts of the income distribution, what they want, they can still only get by being very productive, whereas the lower parts, more and more welfare is moving down. So those are all possible explanations. I don't really have good evidence for any of them. And I say there are probably several others that other people have made or that could be made that I haven't thought of. So if you want a really hot topic, but this is not a hot topic because you aren't the only person working on it, you could think about the interesting project is not exploring one of them, it's exploring all of them. The interesting project is to say, can I make a list of all of the plausible explanations, and can I then figure out a way of testing them to see if we can eliminate some of them? So that the selective breeding one is probably the easiest one to test, because the only question is, on such measures we have of innate ability, have the tails gotten longer? If tails have not gotten longer, we eliminate that explanation. If they have gotten longer, that might not be the reason, but you could then get a little bit further and look at how IQ or whatever or SAT exams or anything correlate with income and see to what extent you could explain it by that pattern. And I'm not sure on the other one, which of the other ones you could get how, but it seems to me it would be very interesting. One interesting question is, are there any countries protectionist enough so that the development of India and China wouldn't have much effect on them? Did they have the same pattern occur? Because they still have the technological effect. So things like that. So anyway, so that's, I think, the last of my ideas, and it's one which I'm not sure I would recommend, but it could get you, you know, op-eds in the New York Times and stuff like that. But anyway, results you get, of course, where you're getting your op-eds. Maybe it's the Wall Street Journal. It's a different kind of result. But what good make you are all the high-profile public policy typers. That's my list of these ideas. I should say I'm going to be around here until about December 9th. Anybody who wants to do any of them and wants to talk about it, you know, mostly I hang around the Public Choice Center because more of the people I'm interested in talking with are there than anywhere else, although a few of them are here, other places as well. Sometimes I hang around here on Fridays or occasionally the whatever they call the building that's got a bunch of other economists over at the other campus because I'm living at Masonvale, so I'm close to the other campus. And with a little bit of research, you can probably find my email address or my phone number. I don't make an effort to keep these things secret. And as I say, if you actually decide you want to do one of these things and want to talk it out with me, feel free to get in touch and talk. That's sort of one of the things I'm here for. All right? Any questions?
Very good. Well, thank Dave.